is, what is it, Monday?
You don't even know what day it is anymore.
I kind of don't. It's Monday night, generational change. I'm Jen.
I'm Peter, and?
And?
We don't have our slides.
I'm going to try to do it again. Okay? I'm going to try to do it again. Apparently, Peter just went on a pontification that I wasn't even aware of.
Yeah, happening. Well, we had some important things to talk about. You know, we've got a lot more important things to talk about with our first wonderful guest that will be coming in a minute, Allison Morrow. This has been a long time coming, I must say, but we certainly are looking forward to it. You're going to kick us out of here, aren't you? We're going to get bounced again.
For what?
No, I'm just saying, we're in trouble.
Well, I don't know what this is now.
Yeah. Maybe we shouldn't mess around.
All right. Well, I don't know what that is now. I don't get rid of it.
Okay. Well, let's hope that this is definitely a problem.
Wait, it's something wrong with this program.
Okay.
All right. Hold on.
I don't want us to get bounced out of our live stream.
I know, but I don't know how to get rid of this now.
I don't either.
Well,
I don't think ending the broadcast would be a good idea.
No, but I don't know how to get it. Oh, there you go. What'd you do? That was good.
Don't worry about it. I think it's just the magic of knowing that I'm not the worst at tech, I guess.
No, but it's like it's way out of my comfort zone. And normally we do have it. You know, that has happened a couple of times, but then the past few times it worked perfectly again. So I thought it was resolved because that's happened before. It's almost like once you do it, you can't do it. And then, yeah.
So, of course, everybody has been talking about the nonsense that took place at the Oscars last night. But, of course, that's not real news.
No.
And somebody who's coming on the show will tell us that it's not real news, but it's entertainment and it gets ratings.
I don't even watch it anymore. Like, I just find it kind of gross. To me, it's just like this disgusting testament to our gluttony and our fucked up priorities. Sorry. And
well, that's
so to me, it's just like I don't want to condone that nonsense. So that's why I choose to not watch. I don't glorify people like that. Like it's just there's something very wrong with us people.
Well, that's exactly why we need to be worried about things that have no bearing on our daily lives.
Yeah.
Hopefully, if it's a talking point, it's a talking point for 5 minutes. But as our first guest, Allison Morrow, is going to tell us, they will bleed this thing as much as they possibly can, literally drawing blood from a stone. If it gets right, if it bleeds, it leads. So if you can draw blood from a stone, you will. And this story, unfortunately, is distracting from really important stories. So without further ado, she is the host of her own YouTube channel, Allison Morrow. I quit TV news. Well, you know what? I think what she's doing is awesome.
I do. And also, Allison was also fired from her job at the Washington. I want to say it's the because of what she was doing on her private show about and what she was saying about COVID and using, you know, talking about science, and it got her fired from her job.
Boy, she's looking pretty good now.
That's a big problem, people.
It sure is. Allison Morrow, welcome to Generational Change.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
So tell me, what was the name of your agency? I know you worked for an agency that fired you.
The Department of Natural Resources, Washington State.
Mm-hmm. Washington State Department of Natural Resources. I knew it was natural something. Yeah. So, I mean, I caught a clip of you talking about how that happened to you. And we are constantly dealing with censorship. And what's amazing is how people are talking about like the canceling thing, when in fact the bigger issue is what this is, which is just actual corporate complete censorship of everything. And So talk a little bit about that, like what happened to you at that, you know, when you were talking about COVID and the kind of things you were saying, which were, you know, science-based. It wasn't like you were, you know, talking crazy talk. So talk about like what happened with that job, because the censorship is a problem.
It wasn't even really what I was saying. It was the people that I was interviewing, what they were saying. So basically my bosses who are government officials, so they are actually bound by the First Amendment in a way that a private corporation is not. They didn't want me publicly associating with doctors and scientists who had different opinions on mandates. Really, that was their big concern, because they have a vaccine mandate and they're the wildfire fighting force for Washington State. And they were requiring all of these wildland firefighters, young people, 18 to 25 year olds in a lot of cases, to get vaccinated. And they knew that there was pushback on that. I mean, it was very obvious that there were going to be a significant amount of people who were going to choose that they were just not going to come back and fight wildfires in Washington State because of this mandate. So even though I never talked about my job shooting videos for them on my private YouTube, you know, channel where I was doing the news analysis stuff. There was literally, people were surprised that I got fired because they didn't even know I had a job. So I wasn't talking about it. I wasn't representing them. And I wasn't even really saying myself a whole lot. I was just seeking out opinions that were different because the focus of my work really is censored ideas and censored people. And so I want to know what they're saying because my former profession of mainstream television news, I realized there was just this bubble that I was living in. And so now I'm kind of on this journey of trying to figure out what I didn't know. And so a lot of that means seeking out opinions that are unpopular for the establishment. And then those are ending up to be the ideas that are censored. So really what my bosses were the most concerned about were the people that I was bringing on, doctors and scientists who they felt like were undermining their policy to require, you know, not just wildland firefighters, all staff, but I think, you know, that's going to be where the rub really comes this year, because we're going to see what happens, how that mandate affects a state that already is really deficient in resources already. And now is, you know, cut itself its nose off to spite its face.
Yeah, that's interesting. You were only talking about mandates, not about the actual science of the vaccine. Like you weren't questioning efficacy of the vaccine, but just like that's amazing.
No. These doctors and scientists were definitely questioning that as it relates to mandates as well. But the, you know, their biggest concern was that they had a mandate, so they needed their talking points that they were using, safe and effective, you have to do it to stop transmission, all those talking points, they needed those to stand as a gold standard. And when you have bioethicists, physicians, scientists saying, well, that's not actually true, there's this other side of all of this, then that undermines, in their opinion, their ability to say to their staff, hey, we're just doing what we have to do. You know, you have to do it if you want to protect everybody. You have to do it if you want to be a team player, if you really want to take care of your other coworkers. And you know, they were just selling it like that. And so any doctor that was like, well, wait a second, I mean, you know, what if you're 18 and you're, I don't even want to say some of the stuff they're saying, because I don't want you guys to get booted. Right. But yeah. You know, but these were not like the, one of the people that was mentioned to me by my boss as very concerning was a guy who runs the medical ethics. Well, he used to run the medical ethics department at the University of California, Irvine, and was suing over his natural immunity. He didn't want to get the vaccine because he already had COVID. He was citing natural immunity. He's a medical ethicist. He runs the medical ethics department at a major academic institution. Why can't you hear from somebody like that? He's not just some bozo out on the street. Even still, why can't I interview a bozo? I mean, seriously, it's my personal time, right? It's like I thought we had this thing called the First Amendment. More and more, I'm starting to wonder. Like my husband was saying to me the other day, like we're talking about some of the January 6th defendants who have been in jail and not even been charged, and it's like been a year and a half later. And he was like, well, this violates your citizenship as, you know, as a U.S. citizen. And I'm like, well, I guess citizenship doesn't mean what you think it means. And, you know, reminds me of that quote from Princess Bride, that I don't think that means what you think it means about inconceivable. It's kind of the same thing. You know, I really started to wonder nowadays, and my bosses were government officials and they didn't think twice about canning meat.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Allison Morrow, and I think you bring up a great point. I think a lot of this has just become so hyper-political. They feel like they can't admit that they've made any mistakes because that would be sort of giving a victory to the other side. And they're trying to hang on to this for as long as possible. I mean, we were very adamant like 6 months ago, even basically saying, look, we're vaccinated, but we are not pushing for mandates under any circumstances. Like, you guys do not understand what this leads to and the type of control the state. People who think that the state doesn't want to control you just hasn't been paying attention. And it even becomes even more interesting when we see what's happening with the way that the media is dealing with the issue of Ukraine right now. I saw your video, by the way. It was very, very well done, basically addressing how, you know, even something like this, everyone has to be broken up into factions. Mm-hmm. Like there is no unifying message anymore. You can't have it. If the uncle in your family is a Republican, whatever side they're on, I'm on the other side. I don't care how foolish I look.
Mm-hmm. And it's not even like you're arguing opinions anymore. You're arguing almost the moral essence of your value as a human being. So you're not sitting at a table over Thanksgiving dinner just saying like, well, I'm a person of equal value of you, but we have different ideas about this. It's like, I am superior. You're a total moron. You're evil. You're ruining the future for my family. You know, it's gone totally bonkers on looking at the idea, but the person as the idea now, like the person is the idea instead of it being a person with an idea. And so we look at the person now as somebody who's just totally anathema. I mean, after the 2016 election, I remember even seeing coworkers of mine. These are people in the news business that were saying all this stuff publicly. I'm like, you know, about people who voted for Trump. And I'm like, you know, I mean, that's fine, I guess, if you think that, but I mean, they felt like it was okay. Like they were morally obligated to write all of these things. And I'm thinking, this is how journalists are thinking, that like, you have to unfriend this person. You can't. So of course the people who are watching the news, I feel like that subtext is affecting the people who watch, because I think we're sending that message. I mean, if we as journalists thought that, we started really, I think, I don't know, maybe 6 to 8 years ago, there was like this new phenomenon that occurred where you were a good journalist if you silenced ideas that you had decided, you know, or like your people had decided were fake or just bad for society. Instead of the way it was when I first started, which was, you know, you were looking for the ideas that were counter narrative, because that was what was new. That this is the essence of news, was like, who is dissenting? Who has a different idea? And now it's like the role of the journalist is to find those people and sort of excommunicate them, figure out how to write something that kind of socially excommunicates them, ideologically excommunicates them, and then signals to the public that if you talk to somebody like this, kind of like what my bosses did, there will be consequences. And I think in that way, just my theory about all of this is that with that, then the people divide themselves. And so those that benefit from division, from that kind of divide and conquer perspective, they don't even have to do it anymore, because we just do it to ourselves. We divide and conquer each other, and then we just keep fighting each other, and they're just they could just sit back and have a mojito, because they don't have to do anything anymore. We do it to ourselves.
Yeah, we talk about that all the time.
There was a poll that was done, I want to say maybe like 3 months ago, if it was even that long ago, where it basically, they did a poll based on your ideological lean, which is either Democrat, Republican, or independent. How much do you trust mainstream news? Between independents and Republicans, both numbers were either under 30% or right around 30%. With Democrats, almost at 80%. Mm-hmm. Why is there such a chasm when it comes to mainstream news from your perspective? Why are liberals in particular so ready, willing, and able to believe what is being fed to them on MSNBC and CNN?
The best theory on this one that I have heard, I think, comes from Matt Taibbi, which is basically that like the journalism profession went from being a blue collar working class person's job to now a position of sort of elite academia and power, frankly. And so there's just this power class. They run in the same circles. They go to the same colleges. They just start thinking the same way. And it usually tends to be that kind of neoliberal establishment way of looking at things in the, you know, sort of academic world. I think it's not necessarily like even, I don't even know if it's really left, to be honest with you, because I have a lot of my audience I would consider on the left side of the spectrum, but also kind of in the same establishment skeptic world as the populist right person. So I would think they would agree on a lot. I don't even know how to use left and right anymore, because it doesn't seem to fit that well. But I do think sort of that, like, I don't know, just neoliberal, which is almost a lot like a neocon, that sort of perspective that just kind of, I don't know if it's because they just all kind of birds of a feather flock together, and then and they don't get out enough, and they're not like representative of working class you know, middle-class Americans anymore. Even though what's weird about it is that you don't really make that much money in news unless you're somebody that's way high up. So my guess is that there's just this authority, this sort of embedded idea of we are authority figures, just like the government, just like these tech oligarchs, just like the Department of Health, you know, these Fauci medical professionals that espouse that kind of you know, whatever the sort of mainline perspective is on COVID, for instance. And we have a responsibility to align with each other and kind of fight the war against disinformation and against people that are trying to worsen what's going on without realizing that they are that. It's like almost this psychological projection where all the blame is put on like YouTubers or other, you know, other people that really have very little power. And they're like, gosh, what do we do with this? And you're like, well, wait a second, you're the mainstream news. Like you have way more power than that person who's got 60,000 subscribers on YouTube. Why are you spending so much energy on trying to get people kicked off of YouTube? It doesn't make any sense. But I think for some reason they feel like they love, for whatever reason, they love to believe that kind of victim narrative that, you know, they have to fight back against this fake news thing and are just not introspective enough, even to this day, even as ratings continue to decline, even as they see the comments in the comment section. I think they almost sometimes think like, this is exactly the reason we have to keep at it, guys, because look at all these ignorant people who would be lost without us, you know?
Yeah.
We just have to keep at it.
Don't the peasants know their place?
It's, you know what? This is the biggest problem. And we talk about it, they're so sanctimonious. Mm-hmm. And there's this like whole class thing that they've created out. Like you said, it's like that used to be a career. I actually went to college for journalism. I you know, I did that for a while. I have an appreciation for it. But what we're talking about, you know, I stopped calling that journalism a long time ago. That's just media. And I think that there is a huge distinction in those things. The people that are in the media are not necessarily journalists. They might be. It could happen, but they're not. And yet they talk like they're just stenographers of whatever corporation or whatever government, you know, branch or whatever it is they're doing. That's the complete opposite of journalism. It's the actual opposite of like journalism is supposed to be the watchdog, not the lapdog. So, I mean, I stopped calling them journalists a long time ago.
And I have talked a lot of times on my channel about how I didn't really ever have managers who encouraged us to be very hawkish about what you just said. And like, there was a time I told my viewers about where we got this press release from the Department of Health. And it basically said there was a local doctor who was essentially experimenting on his patients. And we needed something at 11. And they're like, Allison, just go outside his clinic and just say what the Department of Health said. And, you know, I did it. So I just say, this is, you know, the Department of Health says whatever. And we haven't gotten a statement from this guy. Of course we hadn't, because it's 11 o'clock at night. Why did we run with that story at 11 o'clock? Why didn't we just wait till tomorrow? And I've had a lot of self-reflection and, you know, repentance, I think, in my journey, because I have had to sit back. In fact, I would say at the heart of what I do is trying to really understand how people who, because it would be easy to fix if it was just a bunch, if they were all evil and they knew what they were doing, it would be easy to fix. What's much harder to fix is a bunch of sort of benevolent stormtroopers who just, you know, like, let me give you an example. I had a friend, she's still in the business. She texted me last night after the Oscars. She goes, hey, I have a story idea for you. I saw that Pfizer sponsored the Oscars, and it's just starting to seem weird. Like it's about sales and not public health anymore. And I'm like, it's okay. I'm going to remember.
How long did she go to sleep?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. No. March 2022, you know, like I was like,
hey, at least she woke up, Allison. At least she's there.
That's what I said, actually. I'm like, hey, it took you a while, but better late than never. And I mean, she's still sort of teetering on it. But, you know, yeah, like to your point, why did I say that we should trust the Department of Health more than this doctor? And so one thing I tell people a lot is, with the decline of like investigative journalism and this, the funding of investigative journalism and just this, this sort of meat grinder news cycle that we're in, where it's just like something has to be different every 90 seconds. And you give a reporter a couple hours a day to know what they're talking about. It keeps people, it's like a, it's just like an opiate, an intellectual opiate where, you know, you're just trying to get the job done, trying to get the job done. And you have to eventually amass enough knowledge about something in order to see what you don't know. And then that's what hopefully convicts you. And that's what happened to me. I finally was assigned a beat. I started covering the environment. I covered it for 5 years. After about 3.5 years, I started going, wait a second, you know, I'd come back. I can't, I don't have time to read this report. I really need to read this report. One of my coworkers, I remember, been in the business 45 years. This is towards the end of my career, maybe a few months before I quit. She goes, well, just say what NBC says. You know, they usually are right. And I'm like, that's not, you know, no, I'm the only, I literally was like one of two, if not the only full-time environmental reporter for a TV station in the entire country. There's no way somebody in New York City knew about the Clean Water Act more than I did. I needed to read the Senate report. I didn't have time to read it. So I basically went on air like, well, this is my best guess. But I don't know. And I got sick of doing that. But see, I had to get enough knowledge to realize that I didn't know all this stuff that I needed to know. And I think a lot of reporters, they're just churning it out every day and they're believing this stuff because it's basic psychology. And they're, you know, I think the system itself does not encourage, it just doesn't encourage intellectual pursuit, not just the time, but, you know, when you start speaking against what your coworker is saying, you start getting kind of the side eye. I mean, nowadays they go to training. I mean, they're in training now for how to think about some of these big topics, race or whatever else, where it's like, you have to think about it this way. So imagine if you're somebody who starts saying, well, wait a second, is that, I mean, maybe it's about class, you know, or maybe we should look at this. You could go to HR. So it's become a really punitive environment, I think, too, which is also like, you have to be able to take intellectual risks to be a journalist. You have to, like, to go back to my original story of that doctor, when you don't fund investigative journalism and you don't encourage critical thinking or looking at the government critically, what you do is you like just get a press release from, like you were saying, stenography, right? You get a press release from the Department of Health and you just think the Department of Health doesn't lie. They're here to protect us. They're Department of Health, right? And so if you get, say that the doctor had written us and said, hey, the Department of Health is experimenting on patients. We go, whoa, wait, we need like five other people who will say this. We're going to do a public records request. We're going to need to back this up with evidence. But, and then that story will never run because we don't have time to do that, right? That's how those stories never make it to air, because it's like, we would hold that doctor to a much higher standard than the Department of Health. But the Department of Health sends a press release and we go, oh, you know, it must be true. And then we just run with it. And so you could see how like, Why do we look at the Department of Health and say, you have better intentions than this doctor? And so we'll just repeat whatever you say. Whereas if the doctor said you were experimenting on patients, we'd be like, whoa, you know, we really need to make sure there's evidence for that. Why do we do that? Again, to go back to that like idea that we just see ourselves in these same circles of societal authority figures. I think that's got to be it. And the leadership in newsrooms just, you know, just doesn't encourage journalism, you know, people thinking critically about that messaging.
Yeah. And I think it's an excellent point. You know, look, that people can have their opinions about Fauci and, you know, whether what he was espousing was correct. There were numerous instances where he was double speaking. And even when that is presented, there is this, we can't question the state. We can't question, especially somebody who is Harvard educated or anything like that. They have this idea in their mind that just because you go to, you know, a top school.
What if there was Rutgers?
Yeah, if there was Rutgers, then all bets would be off. I went to Rutgers. So,
clearly.
Yeah.
I had a really good friend who went to Rutgers for grad school. So that's fine by me.
There you go. See?
So I think medical school, right? Isn't there a medical school? Rutgers has a medical school.
There's a great medical school. There's a great.
It's a great everything. Rutgers is the best. Yeah,
basically, Rutgers, if you want to be a doctor, a lawyer, or an actor, is basically
go
there.
Gotta go to Rutgers.
Go to Rutgers.
Yeah, okay. Shape. I'll remember that for my next career.
So, yeah, and I feel like I've had a few myself, but talk a little bit about the off the grid-ish thing. And I like that you call it that because I always use the term I'm veganish. So I thought that it was really kind of funny that you said off the grid-ish. And what inspired that, you know, what's going on with that project?
I think it's a lot related to the same journey I was having professionally, which is just wanting to really know more about the information that I was engaging with, the life that I was living because of that information. And more, I realized that like the stuff I can really know is right outside my window. I can really know what I plant in my garden. I can really know what my horses are doing. I can really know what my toddler's doing. I can really know how to have healthy soil outside my house. I can know what my neighbors are doing, what my neighbors need, what can make my community better locally. The farther away I get from my own land and from my own neighborhood, the harder it is for me to know what I'm doing, like how my ideas or how my money is affecting the world around me. And so I think the idea of sort of like, we bought this Airstream, which we started renovating, which has come to a grinding halt because we had a kid, and hopefully we'll start again soon. You know, the idea of like moving into that and then building a family homestead and everything was both, I think it really was an offshoot of the, my journalism career, and that it was like, okay, I just want to full stop on this intellectual bubble I've been living in, this world of just of not paying attention to details, really. I mean, it's sad to say as a journalist, but just going through the motions every day, just trying to like get your job done and like change the world, but like you don't even really know what you're talking about. I mean, like honestly, I one of the things I said about the news business is if we had just gone on TV every night and said, welcome to the 5 o'clock news, thanks for watching, we had 2 hours to put this together, so this is the best we could do with 2 hours. Take it with a grain of salt. We don't know what we're talking about, so you should definitely do your research. Like, if they started every newscast that way, then I would say that's accurate. You know, that would be fine.
News disclaimer. It's a news disclaimer. Yeah, news disclaimer.
Like, just say, you know, my problem with them is that they just, you know, like, us. I shouldn't say them, but, like, us. Like, as somebody who participated in that, is that we were not honest with the viewers. We believed in a lot of ways that like we were the authorities, but like I said, that started to break down for me when I started to realize like, well, that's not true. I mean, we were told that person's crazy, but I just talked to that person. Like I saw them at a conference where they're not crazy and they're making some interesting points. Like who else, you know, one of the things that really started to end my career was, you know, my bosses loved that I was really into food. I'm really into food sourcing. Really into knowing, you know, buying direct from our local farmers and ranchers, and then like eventually, hopefully, growing, you know, significant amount of food ourselves, and they love that. But like, you know, if I would poke holes in like the USDA or Monsanto, that was totally fine. But then like the doctors who I was following on that particular topic, what I thought was interesting was where like they were coming to Washington State to participate in this conference. This was about vaccine mandates before COVID, because there was a debate over whether they should remove exemptions for vaccine mandates in Washington for schools. And I didn't know that there were doctors who even talked about this stuff. I thought every doctor said every kid should get every vaccine, and that's just the way it is. But these doctors were different. And I had been, and so like, What I was learning from them about food and agriculture was great. But then all of a sudden when I was like, hey, wait a second, should we go to this conference and see what these guys have to say? They were like, no. And, you know, my boss actually told me, even though I was never going to cover it, I just suggested, hey, you could go to this conference if you wanted to, because we usually would put the soccer mom against the Department of Health whenever they would debate these mandates. Maybe go talk to a doctor, you know, and put the doctor against the Department of Health. Don't put the soccer mom against the Department of Health. I was told I was never allowed to pitch an idea about vaccines ever again, because I would dare suggest that they would go to this conference for Informed Choice Washington. And I didn't even, like, dude, I had just gotten vaccines to go to Africa. I did not know what I was stepping myself into. But I'll tell you what, guess who went to the conference after that? me, because I was like, well, I want to know who these people are. Like, if they're that nuts, I mean, how are they practicing physicians? Don't you want to know that these people are practicing physicians and they're totally nuts? Like, isn't that interesting to you as a journalist? So anyway, I went to the conference and that was like the beginning of the end, because I was like, I'd never had a boss say to me like outright, you, it's not even that you can't even cover this. Like, you can't even look to your coworker and say, hey, this is happening. Maybe this would be an interesting event to go to get a different perspective on this topic. I was told I wasn't even allowed to suggest it. I wasn't allowed to pitch it. And so, you know, more and more I was realizing there's so much I don't know. And I think homesteading, it like offers this opportunity to really get to know something small. Like, you think it's small, but it's really not, because it's feeding your family and everything and like participating in the ecosystem that you can have a direct effect on. But to learn something that's like real, you know, to build something that's real, that has, you can see, like, I worked with the soil and I planted the seed and I saw the plant and then I fed it to my kid and I learned this about it and I learned that about it. I had a chicken farmer once write me, because I do videos about this sometimes, and he was telling me about how first they got some chickens, but then they were starting to learn about grain, because now they're feeding their chickens grain and they realized all these things they didn't know about grain, how it goes rancid very quickly and there are all these other problems with it. Well, the only way they could really get around that was to start growing their own grain. So they started doing that. Well, then they had these problems. Now they're like a totally, you know, closed system. They grow their own grain. Like, they're the people who will survive the apocalypse, because they're not dependent on any supply chain. You know, they'll eat their own chickens, their own grain. And I mean, there's just something really cool about that, because those people can say, we know this topic. Like, we may not know what's going on between Ukraine and Russia. We may not know what's really going on with COVID, but like, damn it, we know how to feed chicken. We grew our own grain. Like, we know where all this comes from. And I think that to me is really cool. Like, invest your energy into something you can really know well and has an actual like cause and effect on the environment, on your family, your neighborhood, and I think ultimately your soul.
Yeah, I love that idea. I mean, I totally want chickens. Like, that's definitely something that is in my future, is having chickens. I'll feel much better about eggs that way. I very reluctantly do eat eggs and cheese, and that's my that's my problem. But
well, if a chicken is laying eggs and they're not being, you know, fertilized or anything like that, if it's all natural and those blood orange
yolks. No, it's just that you're not allowed to abuse the critters. So, correct. Like, I have a friend who has a pet duck, and she loves this duck. And this duck lives the life. Let me tell you, this duck has clothes. This duck walks on a leash. This duck is happy. And yes, my friend gets an egg every day from her happy duck. And I don't have any sort of ethical problem with that. I mean, it's a little strange.
Well, that's what I was saying.
But she hand-raised this duck. What else are you going to do? Well, that's so she puts little hats on it and stuff.
Yeah. Well, again, that's the advantage of living off the grid. And I think a lot of people really need to be learning how to do that, because
yeah, it's important.
Things are getting pretty bad out there, wouldn't you say? Because I don't know. I kind of feel like something big.
The apocalypse.
But
something like that. And it actually wouldn't take as much as people think it would take.
No, it just takes one nuke. That's all.
And no, it takes like a catastrophic power failure and some sort of or potential like computer, you know, shutdown or whatever. It takes one such event for a few days and people will not know what to do with themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's COVID did it. There were those like millions of animals were euthanized during COVID because the workers couldn't go to the packing houses. And so the slaughterhouses had to come to a halt. Then all these animals, because you know, when you're raising for volume, it's like you got to keep it moving. And so it's not like my rancher down the road could wait a couple weeks. But, you know, when you're one of these packing houses, it's like you move them in, you move them out. You can't have a backlog. And so I remember seeing gazillions of chickens, at least. I remember, I think pigs, there were a bunch of pigs that were euthanized. And yeah, it's just such a waste. And it is a really vulnerable system. It like the further out, again, like we were saying, the farther out your dollar goes, the farther out, you know, your food or whatever else, there are a lot of pieces that can break off along the way. And like, if you try to shorten that that supply chain. And so there's only like one or two vulnerable spots, then it's a lot easier to, I think, be resilient. Now, even we are going to, our friends who right now are like full-time farmers, they're raising their prices because there's like just the cost of just driving to the market or, you know, going to our meetup spots or whatever is up. And there are supply shortages for like the grain. Like if they're not growing their own grain, that's happening too. So, you know, even if you're buying local, it does have an effect, but less, you'll probably have less of an effect than if you're just going to the grocery store and expecting Tyson Foods to be there.
Right. No, the closer we get to our own backyard and co-ops and stuff like that's, to me, my goal would be to live somewhere where there's like a nice co-op situation.
Right.
But yeah, the closer we get to those types of like little centers of sustainability, that's where we're going to be able to like survive. I think ultimately the fossil fuel thing is going to get to an untenable point in humanity. I don't know if it'll be in my lifetime, but when you start messing with the supply chain, like you said, we've seen this and most people will not be able to survive because most people, especially in the urban places and coastal cities and all those like sanctimonious people that probably have never changed a tire, all of those people are going to be really out of luck when there's fossil fuel problem and the transportation system's just like out of whack. Mm-hmm. People are going to not have things and it's going to get ugly.
Yeah. There's people that are way too comfortable in our society and they're
not self-sustaining.
Well, they really like the virtue signal as well. There's a big difference between getting on a megaphone and saying, I support this, that, and the other thing, but then actually doing something about it. You know, we constantly talk about on our podcast how the issue of our time, there are many issues, but there is really one issue. Corporate special interests completely capturing our government and what comes with it is really that is the issue of our time. And it should be the most unifying issue of our time because it's pretty self-explanatory when you look at how things are done. You know, why we don't have a clean energy grid, why we don't have a living wage, why we don't have health care. Your friend woke up. I'm glad she did. It had taken a long time, but her to say, you know, I think these for-profit insurance companies or these for-profit pharmaceutical companies, they may only care about themselves and not people. Well, right. Good. You finally recognize that.
I highly recommend the movie Dope Sick for anybody who has not or it's a series, like a mini series on Hulu. It's quite good. But that's what I think about with pharma. Like they're not just negligent, they're malicious. These are people that should be in prison. And the fact that they're able to advertise on TV, which by the way, doesn't happen anywhere else.
But they give money to the very people who could put them in prison and say, you're not going to put us in prison.
Right.
And, these are the rules. And that's basically, I think in many ways, the essence of the biggest problem. And so many of the policies that have happened over the past 30 plus years, you can start obviously with what happened in 1987 with the removal of the Fairness Doctrine in the Reagan administration. The even bigger one, of course, was the Telecom Act of 96 in the Clinton administration. All of this, which has compartmentalized and completely monopolized the media sphere, and the fact that corporate power has completely taken it over, I mean, that to me is probably as significant as anything. I mean, a lot of them know what the problems are, but they are they're very comfortable livelihoods are dependent on them pretending like they don't know.
Mm-hmm. When we were talking about homesteading, another major reason that we're doing that is because I think my husband and I are both kind of convinced he's a disabled veteran. We've seen, you know, the promises of the Department of Defense and how they take care of veterans after they come back from war. Because they're not there for them. I mean, who else, like, come on. So I don't think they're gonna be there for me. But can you fight that system with its own weapons? And I don't know if you can. And I think that's why we're pulling out of the system. Kind of the way I look at it is like, I'm taking my basketball off the court. I'm not going to play by your games anymore. And I'm going to work to create something different. And because I just don't know if yelling at you anymore or trying to game your own system, like the system you just described, is possible for the average person. But it is possible for us to start building our own sort of new ways of doing things. And that starts with some of the basics like food. Now, I do wonder, because I've heard homesteaders say this before, and I think they're kind of onto something. will the back to landers be kind of like the next domestic extremists? You know, will we be the ones who are now typified as sort of like the right wing, you know, domestic extremist types who just don't want to be part of the system, you know, like the Ruby Ridge types, even though all we're trying to do is like just grow our own food. Like the thing that was normal 150 years ago is, I bet you, just mark my words, I'll come back on and talk about it if there are talking points on CNN, Brian Stelter does something on it.
Brian Stelter!
Sorry.
Yeah, he said he wouldn't come on my channel. I invited him. He said he couldn't. That's what he said. I couldn't. I can't.
So he big leagued you.
I know.
You know, he's been our bootlicker before. We've had him as a bootlicker, and every time I put his picture up, I do this superimpose this little beanie with the spinny thing on top of it. It really fits him well.
Well,
if you go to his Twitter, it's really interesting. His Twitter picture is probably from 20 years ago, 15 years ago, and I mean, it's like, it's I don't know. It's just interesting, kind of the image that he projects to people, and like, who is the real Brian Stelter? And but yeah,
I'll tell you who Brian Stelter is. He is the definition of the emasculated male who is willing to do anything and everything. No butt he won't kiss, no boot he won't lick to have comfortable life. He is as talentless as any host I have ever seen in media. And yet he looks 45. He's actually 35 and he acts 15. Hmm. And to me, the only reason he's there is exactly why a lot of others in the media are there, because they are ready, willing, and able to do exactly as they're told.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's totally true. Yeah. My response to my friend last night was, be careful asking those questions. You know, you might get fired. So she goes, that would be my luck. And I'm like, well, no, that probably really would happen. So
yeah.
You know, especially like the company that she works for, that I used to work for, they have these initiatives that they like these partnerships they do with the government. Like they see that as totally normal. Like let's, or the like the hospital systems, you know, my old station does paid content from the local hospital. So it's like, they're literally paying for content that is basically hospitalist kind of big pharma content, and we run it like it's news. So that's just totally normal. It's very weird. And again, once again, like I wish I could tell you, cause like I said, if it was just money, that would be like a much easier problem to fix than sort of like this more metaphysical problem of the people who are just the lost. You're just like the lost soul that's just kind of like wandering around, and you think you're doing something right, you think you're benevolent, you think you're helping people, that's why you got into the business, and yet you're not. You're like participating in this very evil messaging and propaganda. And
until I have it,
you just, that's Sorry. How you sleep at night.
I think without question that there are going to be more people like you that are going to eventually break away from what's going on, because I do think that there are people who are starting to get the sense that the, what is it that's at the gate? What's that phrase?
I don't, the Trojan horse?
No.
I don't know what you're talking
but
about.
But basically
the
commoners are at the gate, whatever the specific phrase is, but people are shining their pitchforks. They are. Mm-hmm. And we're really at the point now where we're kind of, I really think the people with power are really tempting fate with how this is going to happen, because it's everyone's thinking, oh, well, there isn't enough buildup. Well, to be honest, it could happen from the smallest thing. It could really just completely spiral in a way that is completely unstoppable. And I do think not only your transition from where you were, but the fact that you have learned sustainable agriculture, I think is something that everybody should be doing. I don't even care if you live in an urban city dwelling. You really should learn how to live
grow
off
food.
The grid.
It's important.
It is.
Well, we should be teaching kids this in school.
We should.
That's another big issue. And we're having a whole conversation about education in a little bit.
Allison, it's been a real pleasure having you on this evening. If there's anything that you want to plug, anything.
Yeah, what
you,
are you working on?
What are you working on?
Well, I just got another video removed from YouTube, so it's probably not the best place to find me. And it was from 2 years ago, so... Oh. They go through your old videos now and decide they don't don't follow the policies of today, and that's totally fine with them. I'm hearing one of my subscribers told me that he's heard from other content creators that people are like losing their channels and getting locked out, but then the channel will reappear, but they can't get into it. And wondering if, like, is this YouTube's new thing where they're going to have like ads and monetization of channels where they're still making money off of it, but the creator has totally lost influence and control over their own work. And I know I'm sure that's like legal in their contract that they make us all sign, right? They basically are like, you've given us your first child in order to be on YouTube. We own all your stuff. Like, we can do whatever we want with it. But it just seems really like, you know, a snake move on their part. So don't necessarily go to YouTube, but you can go to any other platform and find me. Just look for my name, Allison Morrow.
So what you're telling us is that us using YouTube is not such a good idea. So
have a backup.
Yeah, you know what?
Patreon, you're right. Guys, Patreon.
Yeah, Patreon.
But you should have a backup for them too.
Okay, that's a good point.
They boot people off of there.
We definitely need to have you back again specifically to talk about censorship. That would have been a topic that probably would have covered at least 45 minutes. Oh, yeah. But we hope you will come back again. We hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have. And
yeah, thanks, guys.
Absolutely.
Thank you. It was nice meeting you.
You too. Take care. All right, bye.
So she was pretty cool.
She was lovely.
As Jen likes to say.
I do. So I want you to do that and put that up, and I'm going to go run and grab it because that's what has to happen.
All right.
So that's Jen, what's going to happen. So share screen. I got to run.
I'll share screen. All right. Hang on.
That's what I'm trying to tell you.
We'll be right back in 1 minute,
no,
guys.
Go there. Do it the old school way.
Do it the old school way.
And then go in a slideshow presentation, and then it'll be up. And then, yeah.
Yeah, we're old school here, guys. Okay, give us 2 minutes. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
And we're back.
We're back. Yes. I wanted to get my book. People know normally I do audiobooks, but in this case, I actually Kindled. So I wanted to make sure that I got my Kindle because I highlight. I take notes.
Well, without further ado, our second wonderful guest. Very important topic. Public education, the complete dismantling of it in the United States. Yeah, you may have heard about that.
We're having a problem.
It's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, we haven't really addressed just this in and of itself. I think it's really important. But this has to do with the injustice of our public education system in terms of the racial divide and what that really looks like. And we've talked about it with a lot of other things. Sure. And I think that this is very massive. But then again, I believe in having nationally, federally funded schools that every student gets.
Wasn't
the same,
based on property taxes. So
anyway, we're going to talk about that. But our guest, how I came across this gentleman was at the beauty parlor and I was getting my hair done. I was at the parlor and I'm sitting next to a very nice woman and she was talking about, I think it's her nephew. I want to say it's her nephew. Yes, it's her nephew, Zachary. And I was almost having like, you know, your cousin Jeffrey at the Parks Department kind of thing from Uncle Leo, you know, Leo talking about, Jeffrey. No, but you got to see what Jeff. But anyway, so she was telling me that her nephew had a book that he had done about this topic when I told her that I did a podcast. And so I reached out and then, of course, I read it and it's really quite good. So, and you guys, it's a quick read and it's really basic things we can do in our schools to change this, or at least work to change this.
He is the author of Dismantling a Broken System. Zach Wright, welcome to Generational Change.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Hi. Yeah. So did you talk to your aunt about that? Did you tell her that I reached out, Matt?
Yes. Aunt Sylvia. And it's funny. My son's name is Leo. So when you say like the Uncle Leo thing.
Oh, that is fun. But do you know what we're talking about? The Seinfeld.
Of course.
Right. You seem like you're my, I'm Gen X.
Okay. I'm the early 1983. So the Xennial.
That's him. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's him. So talk a little bit. I mean, you're a teacher. You work in the public school system. You've worked in, obviously, vulnerable schools. I mean, places that are overlooked, underfunded, like, you know, those. And so this book was based on your observations, your experience, and, like, what things we can do to help. But talk a little bit about what you saw in terms of the injustice, like, because this is, it really is a black and white situation here.
Yeah. So I've been in education for 15 years. I've taught in private schools, public school, traditional public schools, and charter schools. And now I teach teachers in Philadelphia and in Camden. So essentially what I saw was, and the introduction of the book talks about a student named Aisha. And what we would do is every spring with our seniors, we would sit down with their list of all the schools, colleges they didn't accept it to, with other financial aid award letters. And we had put them to a spreadsheet so that we could see what their out-of-pocket costs would be. And this student, Aisha, was like an incredible student, which I was not in high school. And she was wonderful, top GPAs, internships, extracurriculars, right? All the things. Got into at least 12 schools and could afford none of them. And ended up going to Community College of Philadelphia, which is a really hardworking institution that sees a dropout rate of over 90%. And she ended up dropping out. And what I saw at that moment was that everything is rigged from the get. Because when I was coming, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, with relatively wealthy parents. And I never thought about college. It was just what was assumed the next step. And Aisha deserved more than I did. She worked harder and earned more than I did. But because she grew up in the poorest zip code of the poorest big city in the country, she did not have access. So to me, what that really showed me, which I should have known before, is that education is just a commodity. It's something that's bought and sold. And if you can purchase it, if you can afford it, you can access it. And if you can't, then you don't. And that is the fundamental truth about American education, which flies in the face of what we tell ourselves, which is that education is the way up the social ladder, which is not true.
Yeah. And something else that you talked about pretty early on. Now, I happen to, people know I'm a huge fan of Thurgood Marshall. That's like my idol. And one of the things you talk about when you're talking about Brown versus Board of Education, and it's something I know about regarding health institutions, that desegregation did not help Black communities. Like that, it wasn't something that helped them. And in a lot of cases, it hurt them. I know it affected the amount of Black doctors that were practicing when you desegregated hospitals. And so it really hurt them. So would you explain a little bit how, even though, yes, we agree with separate is not equal, and yes, that's true, but the act of the logistics of desegregation of the schools and what that did.
Yeah, it's an incomplete victory is the way it's been referred to. So because the centering of the conversation about desegregation was focused on, it centered whiteness as the solution. Wherever the white kids were, that's where good education was. So let's move the Black kids to those spaces, right? It didn't center the fact that the solution was solving injustice. It was, let's just get them closer to the white kids. But what that meant was that no school, while school had to take new Black students, didn't have to take Black teachers with them. So about 90% of the Black teaching force was gutted. So what you have is a total decimation of the Black education system, which is what we feel today. Black male educators make up 2% of the teacher corps in this country. So what we have, therefore, is we have students of color being forced into schools, taught by people who don't look like them, who very well may have been anti them coming there in the first place. So, but what we do in this country is we teach Brown versus Board of Ed as the pinnacle of progress and solution. In some ways it is. It's a step forward towards our ideals, but the way we tell the story is a very whitewashed telling, which is the same way we teach Martin Luther King. There's a reason why we generally focus on the I Have a Dream speech. It's a powerful speech, but it also fits into the narrative of colorblindness being the height of progress, and that is not where we want to be.
Right. I mean, the goal would be to properly boost up the Black schools as well. Yes, you integrate, let people go to whatever school is in where they are. But the idea is to create funding that's just. And that's not something that we've seen. I want to talk about that in a second. You had a really good idea about like how to sort of deal with the funding thing and the kind of credits to give for different like obviously PTSD and life experiences that are trauma. These are neighborhoods of people with trauma that live in trauma. But before that, I just wanted, you talked about Black male educators being 2%. I don't think people understand how important that is, that like, or how like tragic that is, because how important it would be to have, I mean, even if, let's just say our educators were at least proportionate to our populace, let's say that, which is still be a minority. Okay. But let's say that. So we talk about how important it is for kids to see, like how many of these kids would have benefited from having Black male teachers?
Yeah. Well, first thing, we would all benefit, right? Well, like, yeah. So like, right. It's for all children. The second thing is there are reasons why disciplinary disparities are reflective of incarceration disparities. If we view children not as children, but as young perpetrators, as young soon-to-be criminals, then we will funnel them down that system. It doesn't mean that white people cannot teach Black kids. I have taught pretty much only Black kids. But what it means is that in order for me to do so in a just manner, I need to investigate my own the Bettina Love refers to it as interrogating the oppressor within. I need to do my work. Whereas, so if I see two kids of color like squaring up, like fighting, like about to play, I'm not triggered into like, we need those kids suspended right now, right? So those things need to happen. And the importance of, I mean, I'm not going to speak for a young Black student. I'll let folks like Sharif El-Mekki and the Center for Black Educator Development do that. But the idea of not having seen someone who looks like you as a teacher for your entire life, all someone who looks like us has to do is flip the script and try to imagine that. And that would feel alienating. That would feel othering. That would feel not totally safe. It's vital. It's necessary. We need to fix it.
Yeah, I agree. And it's a problem in a lot of industries, people. It's the same thing in the medical field. That's what I'm saying. Like I've had this discussion about medical stuff, but not education before. And I think it's really important because it isn't one of those things where you can just pass a law to fix it. This comes down to levels and levels of funding issues. And it's a huge problem because you have teachers are underpaid across the board. That's its own whole separate problem. But I want to focus on fixing the injustice that we see in the funding, and also talk a little bit about what you were saying about charter schools. Because I think it's interesting because I generally am not a supporter of charter school idea. If it's a for-profit situation, we have one in Pembroke Pines that is an excellent charter school. My cousin works there, but it's run by the city and it's a great school. And it's, you know, so there are decent charter schools, but I think that, like you said, it's a commodity. And so people get upset when they think their dollars could be diverted. Well, I do, from the public schools, but obviously the property tax system isn't serving us well as a whole. It's just not working. So what is the solution to equalize? We'll talk about first the numbers, like the in disparate funding numbers, and then about like, what can we, like, how can that be fixed?
Yeah, sure. So there's a lot there. There's a lot there to talk about. So one of the things that makes this very difficult is that because there is no federal guarantee to a quality education, right? Education is mentioned exactly zero times in United States Constitution. Because we don't have a federal guarantee, we have 50 different systems of education. So each system is going to be different with its own idiosyncrasies, right? So anybody who says blanket statements is probably not altogether like on point with it. In the general, the vast majority of systems are funded by property taxes. So essentially, if I live in a wealthy place with higher property taxes, my schools are greater funded. If I want to take Pennsylvania for an example, the school I taught at for a long time in West Philadelphia has about $14,000 a portion per student. If I went 1 mile to the west and crossed City Line Avenue, which is the dividing line between the city and the wealthy suburbs, if I cross that avenue, every student gets $28,000 for their education.
Twice.
And that is based upon Pennsylvania state funding formula. There are some state, and Pennsylvania is pretty much right smack in the middle in terms of progressive versus regressive funding. So there are a lot of states that are worse, and there are some states that are better, but there is no state in the country that is what's called a progressive funding formula. There's no state in the country that gives more to students who need more, right? So that doesn't exist. So that's one thing about funding generally. When I think about school as a commodity, what I think is important to distinguish is that every kind of school in this country is a commodity, every single one. Obviously, private schools are Catholic schools because of tuition. However, a traditional public school is a commodity because I'm purchasing it with my home. I'm purchasing it with the access that I have to my home. And there's a reason why, if you go on Zillow or any one of the other real estates, you'll see bedroom, bathroom, square footage, and school zone. What I'm doing is I'm buying access. So even though I might live in a and send my kids to a traditional public school, if I have to pay $500,000 to live in that coveted school district, I am purchasing access, right? So that's still a commodity. That's still a commoditized thing. So my issue with folks who might be blanket anti-charter school is that two things. One, there are great schools of all types and crappy schools of all types. What I want is a good school. I don't care what it is. I just want a good school. My other issue with it is that some of the most anti-charter proponents who say, I believe in traditional public schools, that's wonderful, but you also probably live in a coveted school district that you exercised your privilege to access. And it doesn't feel right to do that and then say the other parents who can't purchase, nah, you need to stick with what you got, right? That level of injustice doesn't seem right to me. Yeah. So there are a couple of ways to come at this issue. At the federal level is the push for a constitutional amendment to equality education, right? Once that's in the Constitution, then you have the high legal bar, and that is being worked on in higher levels. The other way is through state constitutional Supreme Court cases. And there's one happening in Pennsylvania right now what they do is they say the current funding formula goes against the state constitution that guarantees a student quality education. That being said, though, those cases have happened in certain states and have brought progress, but not the revolutionary progress that we would like to see.
Yeah, I mean, so essentially, education needs to essentially be declared a right before you get to have any say, before you get to sort of demand a better funding situation. But I would like to say that I like your idea better. And I've thought this about a lot of things, like the people, and of course, I've also been called a communist and a socialist, so whatever, but it does make sense to me to give more money to the kids that have suffered the most because it affects their learning. And one thing we do and have done is support an organization called Mobile School Pantry. They provide meals to families in the schools that have the most kids on free and reduced lunch. So, you know, there's definitely schools that we know are vulnerable. And I remember thinking this when I would go and we would do the food there. I'm thinking, they need more money than the kids in the better neighborhoods, not just the same money. That would be a start. That'd be a start, but they need more money because the kids in the suburbs, they don't miss meals in the same way that these kids miss meals. And you cannot learn when you're hungry. And so there's so many things outside of just the school that I feel like kids in vulnerable neighborhoods have to deal with that has to be compensated for in their education. So I know have talked about this, but would you talk about that a little bit? Yeah. Why they need more money?
Sure. So a couple of things here. It comes down to this word that we hear a lot, but it comes down to trauma. But here's why it comes down to trauma. Trauma impacts the brain. if I am living in trauma, of chronic trauma, my brain is living in perpetual fight or flight, which means that I am living in the lower regions of my brain. That is the survivor fight or flight section of my brain. If I am in that space, I literally cannot learn. I literally cannot create the new neural pathways that happen when we learn. That only happens when my fight or flight response is calm. A student who has experienced trauma, chronic levels of trauma, is perpetually in fight or flight mode. So they cannot learn. So what that means is they need the supports, the school counselors, the educated teachers, the trauma-informed practices to first calm a student and make sure they feel safe so that they can learn. Couple of things here. Trauma is universal. It doesn't matter if you're in the wealthiest neighborhood or the poorest neighborhood. Trauma is universal. There is domestic violence everywhere. There is drug use everywhere. There's alcoholism everywhere. That being said, in areas of poverty, certain things get exacerbated. If we are wondering where the next meal is, if we are dealing with incarceration, if we are dealing with police presence, if like those things compound trauma. So that is why a community or a child who is living in trauma needs greater services. To put it in a little different way, the School Counselor Association recommends a ratio of 200 students to one school counselor minimum.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, this is crazy to me, by the way. I'm sorry. Yeah.
The average reality is 400 students to one school counselor. And to me, all of it comes back to this very basic thing. We in America view education as an expenditure to cut rather than an investment to maximize. And it's not something that a good, smart nation does. A smart nation invests in itself. So anybody who pushes back and says, why are we, those kids don't need more money. It's like, well, listen, you're either going to pay for it in schools or you're going to pay for it in prisons. So how do you want to pay for it? This is a very dark thing, but it's true. A prison, if they want to predict how many beds they're going to need, looks at the local third grade test scores. Mm-hmm. And if the percentage of students who are behind in reading in third grade is eerily accurate predictor of future incarceration.
And race.
Mm-hmm. And race and special education. Those are the huge major indicators. So what we need to do as a nation is flip the script on how we view education, because what we need to do is invest in ourselves. And because I might be able to get people invested through justice and through altruism. If I can't, though, then what I need to get you invested in is the fact that it's actually the patriotic thing to do, because it's investment in ourselves. And it's also the way to increase your business. If you want people who have enough money to buy your services or your goods, or if you want workers to work for you, you need to invest in education. And we just don't.
Yeah. For the life of me, I don't understand why people want to be surrounded by stupid people. How are we not all better off with healthy and educated people amongst us? Like, this fact blows my mind on the regular. Like, so we'd rather punish people by not giving them an education. Oh, that'll show us. Mm-hmm. Like, it makes no sense to me. And the counselor thing is a good point, because it isn't just money. It's how it's allocated at some of these schools. Absolutely. Because I would think that schools that are in more vulnerable neighborhoods should have more counselors than the average, not less. And a school that has perfectly happily functioning, you know, two parent households, you know, across the board, probably needs less counselors than a school in a vulnerable neighborhood.
Yeah. I mean, yes. And I'm also going to say it's complicated, because for folks like us, like people in our relative age range, we have no idea what it's like to be a kid today. Like, no idea. Like, the difference, like, we have more in common with someone going to school in the 1800s than we do with our children going to school, right? Because of a phone. Like, we don't really understand what it is to be a young adolescent with Instagram. That's terrifying.
And I've seen some, let's just say, very irresponsible parenting during the developmental stages of a lot of these kids. I was in a situation recently where, I mean, I literally saw a kid in front of a computer screen for 12 hours.
Mm-hmm.
12 hours. I mean, I can't even imagine what type of damage that does to cognitive mm-hmm. development.
Yeah.
And all the while, this is because the parents don't want a parent. I mean, that's part mm-hmm. of it as well. You know, they've got the TV, they've got the computer, they've got the phone. It's like, this is your babysitter now. I'm going to go off and do what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And all the while, you have these teachers that are so overworked, so underpaid, and they break. And in a way, you think that maybe that's the... It is the privatization of our entire society. I think that's what it is. I think that's what it's all about. And in reality, I don't even think they really care that much about race. I think they just care about whether or not they can make a buck. And if they can't make a buck, well, tough shit. That's your problem.
Yeah. And no, the prison industrial complex is real. And it does do that. And I
well, because it's a for-profit industry.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing. I mean, I don't think education should be for I think that public education should not be a for-profit industry ever.
Mm-hmm.
talk a little bit about, let's go back to funding, where you come up with the baseline. Because the idea is you start with this baseline, you know, of what a student should have in order to be properly educated. Like, so how do we come up with that number? I mean, to me, it's like, sure, you assemble a committee of very smart people and they figure it out. It can't be that complicated. And then you come up with a formula, and then you have some ideas, like additional things to add to that to sort of level the playing field. So how do we come up with what is a good baseline number?
Yeah, sure. So there are several different methodologies for coming up with this, and they have very fancy names. Which I may not remember, but essentially one model says, let's get theorists together to come up with a hypothetical. If this is what every student needs, then this is the cost. So that's one thing. Then the other one is more the professional model. It's like, let's get all these teachers together and see what they say. And then the third one, and there are more, but the third one that comes to mind is called the successful school method. It's like, let's look at a school that is just killing it. And let's see what number they have.
Right.
What I like is a combination, because if you just depend on theorists, let's say, then you might be overlooking some realities of individual communities, or you might be relying on biases of what a student might need or not need. If you just focus on teachers, same thing, right? So what I'd like to do is I'd like to combine both the professional judgment model, which says, okay, if I want to bring all these teachers and administrators and theorists together, they come up with a number. And then I look at the successful school model. What school is killing it here? And I look at that number. And whichever one is higher is the one I want. Whichever one is higher is the one I want. So I start with that. That's my baseline that gives me the per pupil expenditure across the board. And then what I do is I add supplements onto it. Special education supplement, a English as a second language supplement, an ACE score, adverse childhood experience for trauma measuring score on top of it. And then you have a little bit more. So every student everywhere, and it should be by state, because states vary so much in like a student in Vermont, comparing a student in Vermont to a student in California may not be accurate. Like that is not necessarily the right thing to do. So within state though makes sense. And then you have the buckets. So you say, okay, everyone is at least guaranteed this base, and then you supplement on top of it. To anybody who says, how do we have money for this? Like Bezos just went into space for fun, right? Like he went to space for fun, like Amazon going into space for fun. The money's there. We need to actually choose to invest in it. The military, I think it's over $700 billion a year. Like we'll take
higher than that.
Like we'll take one, right? We'll take one. And that would do wonders. So the money is there. It's about, do we have the courage or frankly the will to invest in our future through our children?
I have a very important question.
This is something that we talk about a lot, is that when it comes to unions, and this is true with the teachers' unions, and not everybody.
Not going to hold back on this one. Zach.
No, we have some issues.
I think Randy Weingarten is a disgrace.
We have some issues.
And a really big problem for the industry. This also comes with the fact that She has way too much political power. You know, she's much more of a grandstander than she is a doer. When initially Jen was running for Congress against Wasserman Schultz, she made it known right away that she has a personal relationship with Wasserman Schultz, who is as corporate as any representative as you're going to find in the U.S. Congress, Democrat or Republican. And to me, that speaks to the greater issue of these top-down approaches that some of these unions have. Now, I don't want to get into the whole Bernie versus Hillary thing, but the one thing that was universally true during that particular presidential primary, anytime the rank and file was able to vote on a nominee, they always voted for Bernie. Anytime it was a board that voted, it was always for Hillary. Mm-hmm. The teachers' union was certainly the most interesting because the teachers overwhelmingly wanted to go with Bernie, but they went with Hillary because that's what Randy Weingarten wanted. So the question is,
well, I mean, you know, and this was post, I mean, this was from the book, but you know, when we see unions, it's like, we want to back them. We're very pro-labor. That's important to us, mm-hmm. but please distinguish between when unions are working in favor of their teachers and when they're working in the best interest of students. And those are not always the same thing. And like, I've seen it in my life and obviously in my kids' lives, the amount of teachers that get to just sit there with tenure and never have to do anything, and they really suck, and they're being protected at the expense of students. And so this is a problem, and I want to be supportive of labor people. I am, you know, we are, but like, the teacher union is a problem in a lot of cases.
Yeah. So let me start by saying that I've worked both as a union member and as a non-union member. So I've kind of worked in both spheres. The teachers union, like every single union out there, has one job, and that is to protect its membership. So the teachers union job is not to do what's best for students. And it never has been. That is not their job. That's not their role. It should be, but it's not. So the idea that to support a teachers union is to support students is not true. That is not an equal statement, because that is not what the teacher union's priority is. The teachers per union priority is, in my opinion, twofold: to support its current membership and two, to expand its membership. It is a political action committee. It is about supplying lobbying to get power, right? So that's what it is. So to me, a teachers union that is against any and all charter schools is actually not fighting for public education, and they're not really fighting for kids. They're fighting for their own turf. Because if they were fighting for kids, what they would say is, we love good charter schools. We don't like unsuccessful charter schools. And if a teachers union was really for kids, they would say, you know what? That school that we have been failing for 60 years, maybe we should give it up. Right. But they won't, because it's about turf. So to support it, and we live in this either or culture where I'm either for labor or I'm not. And it's more nuanced than that. Yeah. In the book, I kind of outline the things that I really do like about some of the teacher union platforms. And I say, yeah, but this is not, we don't need this. We don't need. Like, teacher accountability is absolutely necessary. Absolutely necessary. And there needs to be a multi-factor faceted system where it's not just end of year tests, but like, no teacher just gets to coast. Like, you don't just get to coast, because bottom line is that's someone else's baby that they're teaching. And like, that's the end of the conversation. So any union that is going to try to like keep an ineffective teacher teaching is not doing what's best for the student. And what I say in the book is like, there is just one question that all of these entities need to ask to guide their actions. Is this good for the child? Is it good for the child? Is a nationwide moratorium against all charter schools good for the child? Not really. It's really good for the teachers union. Is having tenure for all teachers at a certain rate good for? No, it's not good for the child, right? So what I think really needs to happen, and you see this happening in Philly a little bit, is that teacher members themselves need to stand up and say, this is not what our union should be fighting for. we need to be fighting for something else. And that is obviously going to be a tough road, but it's not an impossible road.
So why is it that you see so few union teachers stand up to, you know, let's say some of the local union heads, or dare I say, even against Weingarten, who's been in power for over 30 years? Where does the line get drawn, and will it ever be drawn?
Sure. So I can only say this from my own personal experience, right? So I'm not going to speak for like all these, but I'm going to speak from mine. The pressure inside some schools to walk the line is intense, extremely intense, to the point of like socially outcasted, alienated. You're not walking with the union. Like, you don't need to come into the lounge to have lunch. Like, it is very, it can be very, very intense. That culture can pervade. And I'm only speaking from my own personal experiences, having spoken out against it and been shown the door. So I've done that. I think, though, what you see is that a lot of young teachers are not really with that. And a lot of brand new teachers go to the charter route because it's different. I don't want to have this model. I don't want to have this mode. And whereas I might not be protected by the union, very often my pay is going to jump if I'm successful. I'm in a more progressive space often, not all the time. But the power of the union to get folks in line is admirable, if not a little scary. But what also makes it difficult is that you find yourself with strange political bedfellows that you don't want to be with, right? So if I come out against the union, I have a lot of folks who on Twitter might say like, yeah, we support this guy. But if I look at that person, I'm like, I don't want you supporting me at all. I hate everything about your politics except this one thing. So that gets really messy when you start being when you start challenging teachers' union. You get looped in with a whole like more right wing view of education. Yeah. And it's like, but that's not me either. Right. So it can get politically very messy.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's just, I think that it's a pissing match. It's always a pissing match. It's mm-hmm. They're just fighting over power and they're fighting over territory. And the kids are the people that are just collateral damage. And it's just exponentially worse in vulnerable neighborhoods. It's not that it's good everywhere. Like, we're in Florida, we're 48th out of education, which the travesty is that we're one of the top states of income. So most of the states that are at the bottom in the education list are also poor states.
Right.
Whereas we're a very wealthy state and we're at the bottom of the education list. And that to me is really a profit situation. It's a greed situation, no doubt about it. And the people here, when they're pushing choice and they're pushing charters, it absolutely doesn't. It has to do with their friends that own businesses that are profiting in this way. It isn't because they're coming in to offer options to kids in vulnerable communities. There is nothing benevolent about what I have seen here as far as charter schools and where they're located, by the way. They're not being put in places where they offer a good option to the kids who need it the most. They're just being put as little profit-making tools in the suburbs. That's what we see here.
Interesting.
They're all over the place. And they are. They're little profit makers until they end up going away. And they come and go. And it's just really bad. So it's easy to see why people here are anti-charter. Most of them I have seen are not serving the people that need it the most. I see charter schools a lot in places that have really good public schools. So you're giving choice to a lot of people. That's great. But it's not solving the problem. So what can be done for better oversight? Because, and especially Florida is a lost cause. So, I'm sure you can reference places that aren't as bad as us, but where there's some oversight in this, so that charter schools can be effective and successful.
Yeah. I mean, so right now I live in New Jersey. And so the charter schools that exist in New Jersey are predominantly in Camden, Newark, and Trenton. And they are not perfect, right? And I think that's another thing. It's like, it's not perfect. It's like, no school is, right? So there are issues with them. However, there are reasons why the waiting lists are hundreds, if not thousands, of families long, right? Because the generational schools that have that exist there are not serving. They're not serving the families, and they haven't served families, some of them, for generations, right? So there are reasons. So the first thing to look at is, where are the parents signing up? Because if you have to go through the extra hoop to apply, that's a big deal, right? So that's the first thing to look at, right? So when you say that the charter schools in your area in the suburbs, that's actually very odd to me, because the only charter schools I know of in Philadelphia and the Camden, because that's really my educational universe, are all in the cities. And what they're doing is they're offering very often streamlined educational options. They're saying, okay, let's offer really good pay for effective teachers to encourage them. Let's double down on really intense reading and math interventions and re-accelerate achievement. Now, that being said, a lot of these schools are doing that and doing incredible work. But then the next step that happens is, okay, how do we now go about adding the other things that other just quality suburban schools have? How do we go about adding those pieces into it? So in terms of oversight, it's complicated because, again, every single state has their own unique charter law. Some states, the money from the state goes to the public school system and then to the charter school. So for Pennsylvania, every charter school gets 70 cents on the dollar for every traditional public school. Some would say the money, as you said earlier, was being diverted. That's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is, well, that money is taxpayer money in the first place. And that taxpayer money wasn't going to the public school system. Maybe it's my child's education money. It's hard to know what to say. It's hard to know. I can understand both sides. What to me, it comes down to a very basic thing. I don't begrudge anybody where they choose to send their kid to where they send their kid to school, so long as they are not standing in the way of another family making the same choice for their own. I don't need to live like we choose to live in a small New Jersey town. It's not the best. It's not the worst. It's fine. But it's a privilege that we were able to exercise to live here. So how can I go to another community and say, you know what? You need to go to that school when I was able to choose to live here to access this choice. So it's complicated. But what I think needs to happen, and this is what where the book comes in at, is that every single one of us can do what I believe is hyper-local activism. Every single one of us can identify an injustice in our own school community and agitate to address that injustice. Because if we wait for these large things to happen, we're going to keep waiting. But we can all make a stink about an injustice in our backyards and make some progress.
Zach Wright, you have been an excellent guest, very informative to say the least.
Yeah, guys, check out the book. It's Dismantling of a Broken System. And
website or anything?
I Kindled, guys. So it was
sure. Kindle, yeah. It's on Amazon. It's on Solution Tree Press, but I'm very active on Twitter at ZF Wright. Is on Twitter, and rightsroom.squarespace is my website, where I try to keep updating articles and videos and things like that. So yeah, and I just came up with a toolkit for folks to use to actually use public data sets to identify injustices in their own school systems. So that might be a useful thing for folks as well.
Yeah, guys, it's really cool. I think it's important. And I think that people don't realize that you have a role to play, even if you don't have kids in the school system. You know, like it's this crazy idea that even if you don't have children, again, we're surrounded by people. I'd rather them be smart. That's just me. You know, I'd rather be smart. Guys, so check this out. It's important information. And also something we talk about a lot here is the idea of the importance of nonpartisan local races.
Yes.
And one of those is school board. Mm-hmm. And these are things that are very important. And the more you know about your local school area, then the more, you know, you can be involved and know what issues are going on locally.
Got one more for you. Rightsroom.squarespace.
Yeah, guys, check it out. Check out the book.
Out this information. So make sure you guys check it out. Zach, we really appreciate
it. Thank you so much.
Very informative, and hopefully we'll be in touch in the future.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Absolutely.
Have a great evening.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
He was lovely.
As you said.
That's do you know what it's from? Like, do you know why I always do that?
No.
It's "Your Girl is Lovely, Hubble." And that's from one of my all-time favorite movies, which is it's The Way We Were. It was Barbara Streisand. Oh, she walks up to Robert Redford and she does this. And she's, "Your girl's lovely, Hubble." And it was like this soul-crushing moment for everybody. Like for every woman watching that, like she just ate it and just did that. And it was just, yeah. So that's where I get like Barbara. I don't care what you think about Barbara. That movie's awesome. And it's Robert Redford. He can do no wrong.
He really can do no
wrong.
On Wednesday, we may have a special guest.
I was going to say, what do we have?
Shahid Buttar will be here.
Oh, Shahid. And are we having the candidate we were supposed to be having, or are you changing that?
No, that's for the following week.
Okay. So we're having Shahid on Wednesday.
We may have a special guest. I'm still trying to work it out.
Okay. So the mystery guest, I don't know.
But we hope you guys enjoyed it.
And what else is coming up? And guys, if you like this at all, if you're not a patron, please consider being a patron.
If you could.
It's $5 a month, $10 a month. If you're feeling extremely generous, $25 a month.
That would be very generous.
Honestly, and I would love to get back to doing things that are Patreon member only things. I would. Yeah. We tried it. We had members only meetings that no one came to. Drive
more traffic to the site. I think that's key.
Well, we need help. Yeah, we need a marketing person. We need an SEO person. Whatever. Who is the nice lady who helped us on the campaign with SEO? Maybe she would be willing to help us out, like for an hourly, for like some.
Yeah,
like
the one in California.
Yeah. She's an Indian name. Yeah, she's sweet. What was her?
Hard to get hold of her.
But we need somebody who knows SEO, and we need to be marketing better. We don't do it well, which is ironic considering that's what you do.
Yeah, this is a little different though. We're dealing with a much more serious
And the reality
problem.
Is, even though he's younger than me, technologically we're much more equal than we ought to be.
Yeah.
Well, it's unfortunate.
Okay. Well,
point being, we need somebody. If anybody out there knows about, like, we'd love to have somebody doing TikTok for us. We would love to have
somebody.
We
really got to find somebody for that.
Yeah. We need, guys, if you know people or if you want to help us in any sort
of production, a local person
production
for that,
or social media or SEO.
We need a local person for that. We don't need to be, you know, can announce it.
We can have an SEO person.
We need somebody. If we're going to do TikTok, we need a local person.
Oh, TikTok. For TikTok. Okay. TikTok. I understand that. I'm talking about any sort of marketing or SEO work or any sort of promotion. You guys want to help. And I am very, very amenable, by the way, of talking about somebody on like a commission basis. And I would absolutely be willing to pay people percentages of, you know, what they bring in, because we don't have money to really have a salaried position. And so we rely on either, we could do interns, we could do college credit. But if you think that you can help boost our channel, we'll pay you to do it.
Yeah. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. So seriously, I absolutely would. If somebody went, we know what we're getting on the regular, which is nothing. If somebody comes in and they do something and all of a sudden we see a spike, I'll be very happy to compensate somebody accordingly. And what we're really trying to do is we need off YouTube membership. We need Patreon. And then even as Allison was saying, we should have a backup to that. Although I don't know what that is.
Hey, look, I tried to get us on Rofkin, but they told us to kick rocks. I don't know why. I guess we weren't big time enough for them. So
really, I thought they reached out to us. To
they
come
did.
On there.
And then we tried and it didn't work, but we could try again.
I don't care. I don't need to be on Rockfin.
Yeah. All right. Well,
are the people on there doing really well? Like, has that been really boosting?
I mean, they're doing a lot. I don't know. I don't think so.
I don't think so. What else do we have coming up? That's so we're having, that's it?
Well, we have our 420 event coming up.
And what do we have next week?
Working on it right now.
Oh, so that's, in other words, you don't have anything else in the pipeline right correct. Now.
Not at the moment. So.
But I'll we always come up with really good stuff, guys.
Yeah. It'd be a pity if I stopped doing that.
So apparently you had commented on the Chris Rock and Will Smith thing. I did not know of this until this evening before the show because I saw Kyle did a bit about it. I have a very specific opinion about this, if you're interested.
Not really, okay. But you can share.
I'm going to tell you anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. So my opinion on this is that one, it wasn't an offensive joke. And I'm also going to give Chris Rock the benefit of the doubt that he doesn't know that Jada Smith has alopecia and that he wasn't doing it to be mean. I generally like to give people the benefit of the doubt in that regard. So let's assume that he didn't know. And quite honestly, even if he did, not a mean joke. G.I. Jane was badass. And the reality is Jada is bald. And if he happened to think that that was by choice or for a role, I'm sorry, you're sitting in the front row of the Oscars. It's a fair game roast from a host. And it is hardly offensive, first off. Second of all, I don't care even if it was offensive, okay? There's no hitting. And when somebody gets up and uses physical violence against something that's words, that shows me that that's a very little person who doesn't know how to use words. I would also like to point out that when you saw Will Smith in the first place, he was organically laughing. So basically what happened is he looked over at his wife, he saw she was pissed, and he felt the need to show her what kind of man he was because it didn't offend him in the first place. And that kind of like machismo, act with your fists, protecting my woman, that kind of crap is the mentality that's gotten us to exactly where we are as Homo sapiens. And I got to tell you, not impressive. So no, there's no hitting and that's ridiculous. And I didn't find the joke offensive.
All I can say is
that's what I think.
Nothing like that's ever been done before at the Oscars. And only because Will Smith has such a good reputation that it isn't being made into the bigger deal that it would probably be.
If it were anybody else.
If it was.
Yeah.
The reality is, and this is my opinion, the only reason he didn't get kicked out is because they knew he was going to win the Best Actor Oscar and they couldn't do that.
And quite honestly, he should be appreciative, which I don't think he is, that Chris Rock isn't filing charges against
him. He could. He could change
absolutely,
his mind.
He assaulted him.
The fact that he said he wasn't.
And I am not a Chris Rock fan by any stretch. I really don't care either way, one way or the other. I mean, he's done some good stuff. I don't really, whatever. I think he handled it exceptionally well. I do. I think he handled it exceptionally well. And I think that honestly, Will Smith, like I hope, and I've always liked him. I have no beef with him. I think he's generally smart and well-spoken. I would like to think that upon reflection and some sort of like, you know, inner work, he might look back and realize that maybe that was not the, you know, better way to go. And that maybe I hope he learns from this because I'm sorry, I think it was pitiful.
Yeah. Unfortunately, this is good for the media. This is good to talk about and this gets ratings and it avoids talking about serious issues that affect our everyday lives.
Well, there is that.
So with that said, we will see you guys on Wednesday.
With Shahid and a mystery guest.
Possibly. We'll see. Good night, guys.
Thanks for watching. If you want to support our mission to transform politics into service, please like this video, subscribe, follow us on social media, and consider joining our Patreon, where you'll get early access to our interviews as well as other exclusive content. Links are in the description. Peace out.